ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Arts in 30, your weekly digest of global news in arts and culture. I'm Daniel Browning. As Donald Trump announces sweeping changes to diversity measures after declaring in his inauguration speech that there are only two genders, what does it mean for trans and gender-diverse artists in America? And in Australia, another indie publisher has been sold to a multinational corporation. Will it lead to a bigger platform for authors or a shrinking space for Australian voices? First, the headlines with Skye Kirkham. Hi, Skye.
Hi, Daniel.
Now, Donald Trump's executive orders are already having an impact on America's arts institutions.
They are. The National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. is ending their diversity programs in the wake of an executive order by the U.S. President Donald Trump last week that called diversity, equity and inclusion, or DEI policies, illegal and immoral discrimination programs and called for their termination. The National Gallery had adopted a new mission statement as recently as 2021, which came in the wake of the Black Lives Matter movement and acknowledged a lack of diversity at the institution. At the time, the National Gallery said that it would focus on diversity, equity, access, and inclusion throughout our work to diversify the stories we tell, the ways in which we tell them, and our staff. Now, a spokesperson for the gallery told the New York Times that the museum has closed its office of belonging and inclusion and removed related languages from our website, and that employees in this division have been moved to vacant roles elsewhere. Trump's executive order requires all federal agencies and departments to end their DEI programs within 60 days, and the move by the National Gallery has raised concerns that other museums, including the Smithsonian, which receive federal funding, may follow suit and end their own diversity programs.
I guess it's important, Skye, to say at that point that the executive order relates to federal government bodies, federal government agencies, of which the National Gallery of Art and the Smithsonian These are federal agencies, so the executive order relates to the federal government, really.
Indeed.
Now, what about some big kind of moves for the visual arts, in that Nikki Cumston from the Art Gallery of South Australia is taking on a big new role?
Yeah, this is huge. Nikki's an influential figure in Australian art. She became the inaugural curator of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander art at the Art Gallery of South Australia, or AGSA, back in 2008, and then added to that as the inaugural artistic director of Tanandi, a festival that's gone from strength to strength over the last decade. Now, Nikki is leaving our shores and heading to Kluge Roo Aboriginal Art Collection at the University of Virginia in America, where she will become the director, replacing Margot Smith, who has held the role for 27 years. Now, that museum holds thousands of works and claims to be the most significant collection of its kind outside of Australia. Cumston has said that this will be an opportunity to showcase the artists she's been working with in Australia to an international audience. And Daniel, I know this is another one I'm sure we'll be following on the art show.
Absolutely. Nikki's an absolutely incredible curator, and you know, has done so much work with Tanandi to bring a flowering in the desert to the audiences, even in Adelaide, but internationally as well. She's been a great advocate for the art being made in remote communities, in the APY lands, for example. Now, anything else we need to know?
Text Publishing, which was one of Australia's largest independent publishers, has been acquired by Penguin Random House. It's the third independent Australian publisher to be acquired by a larger firm over the last 12 months. Also, Triple J's Hottest 100 occurred. Chapel Roan took out the number one with Good Luck Babe, pipping Royal Otis's cover of Murder on the Dance Floor at number two. Splendour in the Grass has confirmed that it won't return in 2025 after having already cancelled the 2024 festival. And Oscar nominations are out, with The Brutalist and Wicked both picking up 10 nominations, but it's Amelia Perez, a musical about a Mexican cartel boss who transitions to a woman, that led the field, with 13 nominations, including Best Actress, where Carla Sofia Gascon becomes the first openly trans woman to be nominated for the award.
Thanks, Skye. And Carla Sofia Gascon's nomination for Best Actress in Amelia Perez is part of a wave of amazing trans artists who've been making waves across film, music, art, and writing. Challenging conventional ideas of gender, of sexuality, of identity has been essential to the fabric of art forever. But the critical and cultural recognition of trans artists in recent years has led to some remarkable work entering the mainstream. Against that background, US President Donald Trump has signed an executive order that removes transgender people from the American government's definitions of sex and gender. And it says that gender identity does not provide a meaningful basis for identification. So what's it like being an artist in a country that no longer acknowledges a key part of your identity? And what will it mean for those trying to create art in that environment? Well, Lucy Sont is a writer, critic and artist who documented her own experience in a recent memoir called I Heard Her Call My Name, a memoir of transition. Lucy Sont, welcome to Arts in 30. From the outside, it seems that there's a great deal of work being made by trans artists in America, from your own writing to the music of Anoni, the films of Jane Schoenbrunn, to name check just a few. What's allowed, do you think, for that creative outpouring?
Well, I mean, it's been building to a head. I mean, the critical mass of trans people is just increasing even as these measures come down. And nobody knows what's going to happen, really. There are places where certain red states are already in the process of denying all gender marker changes in birth certificates, driver's licenses, all those sort of things. And it looks like there's a window coming down on the passport, so people are racing to do that. Beyond that, it's hard to say. They did specifically say that these measures banning gender marker changes will not be retroactive. So knocking on wood on that bit for now.
So the impact of that would be that anyone who'd been gender reassigned would revert to their previous status? Is that what could possibly happen?
Yeah, I guess so. And actually the very worst thing I've heard is that Florida has decided to move all its transgender prisoners to the prisons assigned at birth. That is really sinister.
That is very dark.
Because you know what will happen. They're sending these people to be murdered, period.
Lucy, can I ask as a writer and can I ask for a personal reflection? I mean, those are some very extreme circumstances that we've outlined there. But I guess as a writer, an artist and a trans woman, what's your response to Trump's the executive order, but also his declaration at the inauguration that there are only two genders?
It's been a worldwide movement. I mean, I suspect the hand of certain Christian groups in this, the same ones who basically went around the world offering dictators the mantle of Christianity as long as they persecuted gay people. I think they're behind part of this push. The other thing is just generalized fear, because let's face it, a lot of cis people in the United States who are undereducated and incurious, they will believe any kind of garbage. They don't know what this is unless they do, and they're hiding it deep within. I mean, it's partly why I wrote my book. A lot of trans literature is for trans people, by trans people, about trans people. But, you know, mine, I wrote it to speak to young people, to people like me who might have been burying this for decades, to parents of trans kids, and to my own cisgender friends who, you know, they were very supportive, but they were pretty much as ignorant as these other people. You know, nobody really understands that it's not a choice, and that many people would rather not be trans, actually. You know, we'd rather be that gender than be trans. This is not true for everybody. Some people wear transness as a battle flag, and I can dig that. I'm 70 years old. How long do I have left? You know, I'm not really scared because what can they really do to me, you know?
Can I ask if you've had any conversations with other artists about, you know, this kind of shrinking space that trans artists have kind of achieved within America? Is there any other kind of feeling that you're getting from them about how hard it might be in the future to create work?
Look, I've been to trans literary events and I'm 40 years older than the norm, you know? In fact, I was looking at my reviews and realizing that okay, I got one review in the TLS by an obvious TERF, and then I got a review in some sock puppet right-wing so-called intellectual journal. But besides that, the other harshest reviews I got were all from within the translit world. And basically it was that, you know, I'm explaining things to people who shouldn't have to have it explained to them, except they do, you know, they do have to have it explained to them. I mean, how else are they going to find out?
What do you think artists, trans artists might do in, you know, for the next 4 years to reach cis audiences? Because it sounds to me like that still has to happen.
I do think that it helps to, if you're going to talk to people and you hope to change minds, then, you know, having a popular medium at your disposal is helpful. If you're talking to other trans people, then go ahead and do performance art. But, you know, you're not, it depends on what you're seeking to say. My case is very particular. I want to articulate my existence very clearly for people who might not otherwise know. I'm, you know, I can't reject the cis world because I spent most of my life there and most of my friends lived there. You know, it's, my experience is very different.
Lucy Sont, writer, critic and artist who documented her own experience in a recent memoir called I Heard Her Call My Name, a memoir of transition. I'm Daniel Browning and you're listening to Arts in 30 on ABC Radio National, ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. Now, Text Publishing, which was one of Australia's largest independent publishers, has been acquired by global publishing giant Penguin Random House. It's the third independent Australian publisher to be acquired by a larger firm over the last 12 months, with Affirm Press joining Simon & Schuster and Pantera Press becoming part of Hardy Grant, a larger Australian press. Well, Dr. Alice Grundy is the managing editor of Australia Institute Press and has a PhD on the history of editing and publishing. Now, Alice, what's the importance of text publishing for those who don't follow the industry very closely, and why does it matter?
Text is a publisher that has some unusual books in its backlist, especially books in translation. In Australia, it's pretty difficult to make money from books in translation, partly because it's so expensive to produce literary translations. But one of the co-owners of Text, Penny Houston, is a very talented translator. And so as a publisher, they have produced local translations of books such as Nobel Prize winner Patrick Mondiano's novels. But another really important thing that Text has done is Text Classics, which is where they have released editions for out-of-print books, including by some of Australia's most celebrated and best authors, such as Thea Astley. And those books would otherwise be pretty difficult and expensive to get a hand to get a hold of. And they've made it so that they're widely available and quite cheaply too.
Now, you've also got the winners of the Booker Prize, Miles Franklin, of Stella. I mean, Text has always had really great titles.
Yes, it's partly because of the concern with literary work that publisher Michael Haywood has, but also they've been a publisher that's interested in publishing debut authors. So Jennifer Down and Claire Wright, both of whom are prize winners, as you mentioned. But Robbie Arnott is another example. They have been the first home for some really celebrated Australian writers.
Now, what's the role of the smaller independent publishers? Is it like what you're saying, bringing the back catalogue, classic Australian literature, new writers? Is that the role that smaller independents play?
It's not always the case, but it's often the case that independents are operating according to a different drive. So really big commercial publishers, the ultimate decisions that they have to make have to be concerned with the bottom line because their company is owned by shareholders. But for a company such as Text that's privately owned, it means that a lot of their decisions are based on different things other than just the commercial imperative. So for publishers who have a real passion for Australian literature, it means that they're publishing books that may well make a loss and books that are a kind of, sometimes can be a kind of training ground for authors. So it may be their first book and there may be an opportunity for that kind of ongoing editorial work that really helps writers develop their craft.
Now, Affirm and Pantera were both relatively new publishers. This is an industry that can see publishers come and go. So does it matter if a few of them merge or become, you know, part of larger, you know, global corporations, I suppose?
There's an argument that becoming part of a big international publisher gives the editors working in that house access to different resources that they might not otherwise have. And there's an argument that the Australian authors who are published as part of that merged company might be able to get into international markets. But history shows us that that's just not always the case, and that it has happened several times in the past that the merged publisher has, over a period of time, simply been swallowed entirely by the company and that the imprint no longer exists.
Hmm. So why are you concerned about these recent acquisitions? There's a bit of a trend with these small publishers going to these global multinational corporations.
Well, as a fan of Australian literature, something that worries me is that there will be fewer opportunities for new authors to find a home for their work. And one of the things that happens, say you're a new author and you have an agent, the agent is pitching the work to different publishing companies. The fewer companies there are, the fewer opportunities there is for an editor to fall in love with the work and publish it. And within houses, the companies don't want to compete against themselves. So in some companies, there will be an either written or unwritten rule that editors within that house can't bid simultaneously on the same book. So it reduces the number of options, which can have a flow-on effect for advances, but also simply for books being picked up altogether.
You mentioned Michael Hayward, the publisher at Text. He said there will be a charter of independence around the imprint, protecting Text's identity within Penguin Random House. Does that address any of your concerns?
It would do if the charter were to be strictly upheld and enforced. But I can't speak to it precisely. I haven't read the charter and I don't know the terms of their agreement. But what the history tells us is that it's just not always as simple as that of carving a business out. And we are talking about businesses here, while I've also used the words literature and I've said that I'm a fan. When it comes down to it, publishing is a business, especially when you're talking about major multinational corporations.
Now, Michael Hayward's told ABC Arts that publishing in Australia has become more challenging due to the increasing costs and the rise of Amazon. How should publishers balance competition in a global market versus the impact on the Australian market?
There are a few ways. The first is that in Australia, literature receives hardly any funding of the total arts budget. So it's really an opportunity for the government to support our local culture. One thing people have said is that ebooks significantly reduce costs, but most of the costs associated with creating a book are still there with ebooks. You still have to pay the author and the editor, you still have to pay a designer. So when we're looking at how to save Australian publishers from a similar fate, it's partly support from government, but it's also support from readers. If you love an Australian book, tell a friend.
We alluded there to the role of government. I mean, I only discovered as a first-time writer in the last, year and a half, 2 years, how underfunded literature is as a kind of like cultural enterprise. What do you think the role of the government is in Australian publishing? Does it do enough to protect the industry, to actually foster a culture where people write and we kind of report back on Australian culture?
Sometimes people have the misperception that writing is cheap or pretty much free. The idea is that you can just do the work on your laptop at home and so all it costs you is your time. But of course, that's forgetting that time is really expensive and valuable. And so in order to develop literary culture, I mean, an example of a really strong success is the writing culture in Western Sydney. And that didn't happen by accident. That was a combination of work from Western Sydney University, from academics and funding bodies who supported the writers. And so out of that, we have writers such as Michael Muhammad Ahmed and Felicity Castagna, who've gone on to really significant success. But it doesn't happen by accident. It needs the support at the grassroots level.
Alice, thanks for being my guest here on Arts in 30.
Thanks so much for having me.
Dr. Alice Grundy, Managing Editor of Australia Institute Press, who has a PhD on the history of editing and publishing. And for more on this story, head to the ABC Arts page where Nicola Heath has been reporting on this for us. You can find a link in the show notes. I'm Daniel Browning and you're listening to Arts in 30 on Radio National. Arts in 30 is just one of a family of art shows across the ABC. And every so often, I want to point you to a highlight that you might have missed. This week, it's the music show, where Andrew Ford was joined by Wiradjuri musicologist Dr. Laura Case to talk about the history of the violin in Australia. It's a story that takes in class and gender, but also lets us in on more surprising twists, like the way the violin has, in recent times, been an instrument of resistance for First Nations artists. Here's Laura.
The first more widespread accounts of Aboriginal people playing the violin is during the assimilation era. It was often used as a tool for civilization, trying to civilize Aboriginal people on the missions. So they were being forced to learn music. And obviously that's, you know, a very sad part of our history. But it was also, you know, one of the only things that was somewhat enjoyable for a lot of people during that time. So a lot of the First Nations people really enjoyed their music lessons, actually. But I find it interesting what happened as they come off the missions, because a lot of Aboriginal people continued to play the violin and they started to use it much more organically. So around campfires, in corroborees, in bands, and we start to see the violin becoming part of the musical landscape in Aboriginal communities.
That's very interesting. So do we have any evidence of what they played?
Not in the early sort of accounts. I don't have much at all of what they were playing, unfortunately. There are pictures. There are pictures from the missions, and there are pictures of some really early Aboriginal bands, and they say, oh, you know, the accounts might say, oh, they played the violins in a corroboree. Sometimes there were missionaries who would put on events or shows to demonstrate the good work that they've been doing. And at that point, they would get an Aboriginal person to play the violin and they would have a gum leaf. And so that time they were mostly playing hymns and spirituals. That's what they were being taught on the missions and kind of demonstrating to people. But the Cape Barren Fiddlers are a very interesting group of two Aboriginal men from Cape Barren Island near Tasmania. And we do know that they were playing some fiddle music. And there's some recordings from the 1960s or 1970s. So we're talking a much later period here. But they were descendant, I believe, from sealers in that area. And so they've got this interesting sort of mix of things that they're bringing into this repertoire that they're playing. And this is a traditional tune, Irish tune. It's called The Black Cat Piddled in the White Cat's Eye. but we do know that they were playing this one because we have recordings of it. So this is how this one goes.
And you can hear the full episode titled The Violin in the Colony on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. Every week here on Arts in 30, I'll be joined by a music specialist from across the ABC to bring you the one track that you should be adding to your playlist. And this week, Sarah Gladys from Triple J Unearthed has you covered. Sarah, what do you have for us this week?
Hi there, Daniel. I've got Don West coming out of Sydney for you. He is an artist who grew up listening to, Motown greats like Bill Withers, Al Green, Marvin Gaye, and I recall being, 8 or 9 years old in the car on the way to school, and I would know which Al Green album my sister had popped into the car based on whether it's Sha-La-La played or Let's Stay Together. And I think Don had a similar upbringing with his brother and listening to this type of music, and he's making music that's not reinventing the wheel, however, has the ability to connect with young Australians with this nostalgic sound.
So Don's a young fellow. Is he just playing gigs at around locally, or is he like in his bedroom? A little bit more about Don.
He's in his mid to late 20s. He kind of found music through his brother growing up. His brother had a band called Sons of the East, which had, the success to perform overseas in the US and in Europe, and he followed along with them in the last decade, and now he's making his own music. He and his songwriting partner go to a studio in Kiama in New South Wales, and they record all of their instruments to tape, their vocals to tape, and they're keeping it analog to keep that Motown style feel.
Love that analog sound. It's just something really rich about it. Sarah, you're our music correspondent for this week. I might get you to throw to our track.
Okay, no worries. This is Small Change. You might be hearing more of Don West in future because he's blowing up.
That was Don West with Small Change, the song chosen by our music correspondent this week, Sarah Gladys from Triple J Unearthed. And that's Arts in 30 for another week. The show is produced by Sky Kirkham. Our executive producer is C. Benedict. Riley Mellis is our sound engineer. I'm Daniel Browning. I'll be back with you next week.